This is ensemble member Molly Regan, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theatre Company podcast.
Hello, this is Joy Meads. I'm the literary manager at Steppenwolf Theatre Company, and I'm talking with John Barry, the director of our production of A Separate Piece with Steppenwolf Ring Adults. Hello, John.
Hi, Joy.
So I just wanted to start out speaking about the novel. Can you tell me about your experience when you first read A Separate Piece? What stood out for you?
Sure. I was not like sort of one of the huddled high school masses who have to read it in their curriculum. So the first experience that I had was actually reading Nancy Gilson's adaptation and then going back and reading the novel when I was first approached with the job about a year ago. The novel for me, the character of Jean, who is sort of the narrating, is about my age and looking back at sort of a really important time in his life and his high school experience. So I immediately kind of glommed on to who this person was, and I feel like we're all sort of hitting that time in our mid-30s. The design team is all sort of in the mid-30s as well, where, you look back at where you've come from and a little bit about where you're going. And for me, that was sort of really, really beautifully resonant to think about how we are defined as individuals and, where the shifts in our life occur and how we sort of land where we have landed. Coming back here to work, which is a place that I worked at 12 years ago, It had a lot of resonance for me just in terms of, you don't know at the time the decisions that you make are going to have such a profound effect over everything that you do in your life. And that for me was a really important, important sort of way into the work and really, really resonated with me and was important to kind of tell the story from like my personal perspective.
It's interesting that you talk about the novel is told from the perspective of the older Jean, because, of course, the novel is a memory story, but the play eliminates that narrator. It's told, focusing on the story of the young men in the play.
Right.
And you talked about mourning the loss of the narrator of the play. Can you tell me what's the importance of memory in this story for you, and how have you attempted to retain that in your production?
Sure. For me, the memory, the older Jean is looking back at a time in his life when he didn't fully understand the ramifications of his actions and sort of how that then propelled him into the life that he now lives. So he's looking back at this time with the perspective of, I am who I am now because of these incidents. So for me, I think the novel is tinged with that perspective. There is a little bit of melancholy to the looking back. There is a wish and a yearn for that simpler time when things were perhaps a little bit more black and white for him. And I think that without that perspective, just told from the very first person scenario of the boys, in the kind of a present moment, there's a callowness to the youth, I think, that Jean, older Jean, the narrator, is addressing in some ways. We didn't understand, we didn't really fully grasp what we were doing. So without the sort of presence of that perspective, it can read to me a little bit callow, a little bit sort of simplified. And one of the other things that the adapter, Nancy Gilson, has done, I think, rightfully so, has put some of the older Jean's insight into the mouth of the younger Jean. So for me, occasionally you would run up against a young man saying some things that felt a little wise for his years.
I'm interested to hear you talk about the set. Of course, A Separate Piece and the brother-sister plays are both running in the upstairs theater right now. So your set had to live on top of the industrial black and white backdrop for the brother-sister plays. Can you talk about how you incorporated the brother-sister plays set into your design?
Sure. Before we had seen the design at all, we'd had a lot of conversation with the design team about the fact the separate piece is a coming-of-age story and what exactly that means. And one of the first things we talked about was that it's a time when a simplified understanding of the world in the terms of these students' minds, a sort of black-and-white understanding, begins to take on shades of gray. The clarity of things that they once knew are now sort of, you know, muddied by information. There's not very strong, like, black and white, good and evil. There are moments that that are more challenging to classify. So we had that conversation before we knew what the what James had come up with for the brother-sister plays. And then when we did get a look at the design, we were thrilled to see that he had basically given us a big open playing space, and then he'd his design, I think, came from Bayou Forests in Louisiana. He has these beautiful black and white sort of striped paint treatments going over the back walls and the floor that absolutely made us think of, oh, this is what we've been talking about in this sort of black and white world. So we got really lucky in that sense that thematically, the sort of road we'd already been taking was really, really neatly joined by what James and Tina were working on in Brother Sister. And I think, you know, the plays, I love that, you know, Terrell wrote a play about, you know, kind of people coming of age as well. And these, you know, the sort of three primary characters in each of those plays are going through, I think, really similar journeys that Gene ends up going through. So it's a luck of programming, but we got really, really lucky in this world that we were inheriting. So ways we tried to incorporate that then, we had this research of this white room that we really, really loved, and it looked great in contrast to the sort of black grayed world that James had given us. The shadow of the tree is then cut out into the floor, and we pulled the paint treatment of the brother-sister's play sort of through, so it looks like it's actually sort of, you know, it's meant to live in the space as opposed to something that's just been dropped in. You know, in terms of lighting design, we also inherit a complete lighting design plot. And in a really sort of nice coincidence, my lighting designer, Heather Gilbert, was Scott Zielinski's, you know, sort of prize pupil and assistant for like 7 or 10 years as she was starting her career out. So there was a real nice, like, intimate knowledge that she had of what Scott was going to put into the air, and, you know, a lot of really nice coincidences that I think I don't feel right now at all that we are lacking, or that we had to kind of give up any ideas because we are inheriting space. And the Steppenwolf folks have been here just unbelievable in their ability to do everything that we've asked and be really generous with their time and with their work, and really kind of make us feel like we have a complete design experience up there.
It's a beautiful set, and it's interesting that you talk about that tree, which is such a dominant image in the set, and of course also appears on the cover of most editions of a separate piece. You know, at the end of the play, Mr. Prudhomme says, "We had a tree like this when I was growing up over a lake. I never climbed it. When I was small, I was always too frightened, and then when I got bigger, I was too smart. I never jumped blindly into anything, Gene, not even water." The play begins and ends with that image of jumping from the tree. And I just want to know, what do you think the meaning of that action is? What does it mean to jump out of that tree?
Sure. It's funny because Al Wilder, who's playing Mr. Prudhomme, we had a lot of really long discussion about what that last speech of his was. And some of it is from the novel, but some of it is Nancy Gilson's edition. And you know, what we've talked about from Al's standpoint as Mr. Prudhomme coming into that is, you know, he looks at that as an opportunity that he didn't take or that he didn't get to take. And now that he has sort of passed that time, he has the wisdom of knowing better but lacks the experience of having done it. I think so much of the rite of passage of sort of boys becoming men is about confronting challenge in that kind of, you know, really clear, profound way of actually, in this case, I have to climb up to a sort of an impossible height, edge out on a wavery branch, and take a leap of faith into water to sort of pass this this test of Finney's that he's come up with. And I think that what Finney sees that as is, with the presence of the war and the knowledge that these boys at 16 are going to become draftable in a year, that there's he seems to have an understanding that this group particularly is going to have challenges that perhaps other groups, you know, before them didn't, and that a lot of that is going to be about, you know, facing these challenges in a really sort of strong way and being able to, in the face of something that is, you know, terrifying and fearful, being kind of true to yourself within that and, you know, finding that strength to kind of persevere. You know, and it goes all the way back to, you know, certainly Native American rituals and, you know, these rites of passage of, you know, boys into men, of, you know, sending, you know, young boys into the hunt for the very first time alone, and they can't come back until they've killed an animal. I mean, it has for me, you know, it's 1942, so there is a little bit of sort of refinement to it, but you know, it's still that just that act of bravery that is necessary to sort of propel you into the next place.
It's interesting that this particular rite of passage is juxtaposed with the war, with the question of World War II, and that historical context is so important for this play. The war, in many ways, defines the boys' lives. They face the prospect of being drafted as soon as they graduate and the choice of whether or not to volunteer before that time. High school students today are also studying in a time of war, but the immediate effects of these wars are largely confined to those who volunteer for service and the service people's families. Was the difference in the meaning of war in the two ages between World War II and today, was that a challenge for you as you staged it in making the play relevant for today's audiences?
I think one of the big discussions we had, particularly with the actors, in terms of how we deal with the presence of war in this play is the sort of propaganda and the idea behind the war, in that the World War II being the sort of, in terms of American involvement, there wasn't any kind of question of, you know, I won't say wasn't any. There was a more limited resistance to the idea behind the war, and there was a much sort of clearer understanding of why we were doing it. At least there was a clear understanding of, you know, presented to the public. And, you know, historians sort of argue now about whether that is entirely true. But for these boys, at least, the reason of why to fight was very clear. And, you know, this is also a group of people who, the boys in the play would have been born sort of in the middle of the Depression, would have grown up sort of during that. And one of the things that is, I think, present is that there is suddenly, you know, money again. People are suddenly, you know, out of that sort of thriftiness that was necessary to survive during the Depression, and yet there were now no products to buy because everything was being sort of rationed and used for this war effort. And I think that was one of the big shifts that we had to think about too, was that, you know, we have, I think, you know, called a luxury at this time of our lives of being able to sort of live as we want without much sacrifice personally, you know, to a war effort. And these boys were giving up a lot to go there. And there's talk in the play about sort of giving up of maids and giving up of, you know, different levels of food that was being provided for them in this time. So I think in terms of that conversation, I just had to sort of shift the boys' mindset a little bit to the sort of all-encompassing factor of, you know, what the world was at war, and everything was sort of being given over to the war effort. I think that the challenge now is that, you know, if you don't turn on CNN or, you know, manage to sort of, you can get away from it, I think, here, and you can escape from it here. And I think that we have a sort of more cynical view of why we are currently fighting. A lot of young people do, I think. So that was a lot of conversation about sort of, you know, because they are a political group, my actors, which is really lovely to have these discussions with them. But, you know, their politics didn't necessarily jive with the politics that would have been true of, you know, of 1942. And it's been really helpful to have Val Wilder in the cast, who is who was a product of the 60s and that generation, whose parents fought in World War II and who's been really vocal about the sort of dramaturgy of that. He is a World War II buff himself. And, you know, I mean, he's been sort of our barometer in terms of, well, actually, you know, we might be thinking a little bit differently at this time. So it's been really great to kind of have that presence around.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking with us today, John. For more information on a separate piece or to learn more about Steppenwolf Theatre Company, please visit us online at www.steppenwolf.org.